positioning that inventory in many locations, it's conceivable to position 3D printers at these locations instead to create the final form of products only when customers demand them. So instead of stocking expensive finished goods on a speculative basis, guessing how much to build in advance of the need and where to keep it, companies could stock raw materials. Raw materials are cheaper than finished goods, and they're less likely to become obsolete since they can be made into different types of products. This would dramatically reduce risk and lower holding cost. Change is the only constant, so they say. That certainly seems to apply to the notion of managing inventory. The effort to right-size inventory is constantly in flux, with changes in business and new technologies seeming to come online all the time. But that's what makes it so fun and challenging. For as soon as you think you have it figured out, the variables change and you have to find a new solution.
This lecture is titled Managing Supply and Suppliers.
When most people think of purchasing, procurement, or supply management, they ordinarily think of the business department responsible for buying stuff that feeds the business. It could be the raw materials, produced goods, spare parts, services, or even office supplies. But whatever it involves, the action of buying stuff doesn't sound especially glamorous or sophisticated. And that might be the case if the department's sole responsibility were negotiating price with suppliers, shaking hands, and moving on. But modern supply management is anything but mundane. Let's consider, for instance, that this one department can account for well over half of the company's total spend. Let's also consider that this one department can itself render a company profitable or unprofitable based on the prices and terms negotiated with suppliers. Supply management also serves as the gatekeeper of quality for the company. Procuring shoddy supplies is a surefire way to incur defects in your products that can get passed along to customers. Along with considerations of quality, the company's position on sustainability will rest in large measure with the greenness of the inputs procured through supply management. And finally, let's also consider that this function sets the tone for suppliers' eagerness to collaborate and innovate with your company. Clearly, we're talking about a series of decisions that involve the long-term profitability and lasting reputation of the company, a set of strategic considerations essential for any organization to manage effectively. In this lecture, we'll explore how you can leverage effective supply management practices to not only keep the machine running in your business, but also to set it apart from others. We'll examine fundamental questions around what to buy, how to select suppliers, and how to make the really good suppliers excited about doing business with you. There was a time when supply management was in fact a lot less exciting than it is today. The traditional role of the purchasing organization was to acquire the necessary materials, goods, and services essential to feeding the operation, and to do so at the lowest possible price. The purchasing group might from time to time be called out for purchasing supplies in the wrong quantities, either too little or too much, or of inferior quality, but buyers were generally responsible for finding that lowest price. The work itself was rather transactional in nature. Once suppliers were selected and negotiations closed, buyers kept their eyes on inventory levels and purchased replenishments as needed. Over time, purchasing evolved into procurement, which expanded the set of activities and elevated the strategic focus of the task. Beyond merely buying stuff, procurement professionals assess the quality of competing suppliers and establish supplier qualifications, requirements that suppliers must meet in order to compete for the business. They went beyond auditing supplies to establishing material specifications. They also got out of the office and inspected suppliers' processes and tried to understand the suppliers' cost, not just the prices they charged. They developed an understanding of supplier operations and opportunities for quality improvements by engaging in a more immersive experience with suppliers, one of value engineering, where buyers and suppliers figure out ways to reduce cost together. The evolution continued to a point where over the past two decades, what I just described for procurement has given way to supply management, which is even more strategic for the business and collaborative with suppliers. As you'll see, supply management seeks to achieve competitive advantage by way of working most effectively with choice suppliers. This might mean engaging suppliers early in the development of new products and services, or soliciting ideas for new products and services from suppliers. Strategic supply management means engaging in continuous improvement of processes with suppliers, lending resources to one another to problem solve, reduce waste, make it better and easier to do business. It may also mean forming strategic alliances with select suppliers and on occasion forming joint venture activities or co-branding products. This brings us to modern times, where supply management controls not only a considerable share of the company's budget, but influences the very competitiveness of the company through its connection with other business strategies and departments. One industry phenomenon that has accelerated the influence of supply management is the rampant adoption of outsourcing over the past three decades. As we've seen, companies are electing to outsource activities that they no longer view as strengths of the company, choosing instead to focus on a limited number of core competencies. As companies decide to buy services through outsourcing provisions rather than make or perform activities themselves, the role of supply management expands. Supply management usually assumes responsibility for selecting the outside suppliers, negotiating the arrangement, and monitoring the provision of services. The decision to make or buy, which we've explored previously, involves a series of complicated questions that have become vital for supply management personnel. As you'll recall, however, the ultimate question focuses on control. If we sense that there's much to be gained or much at risk with particular business activities, then control seems essential, and companies will usually elect to internalize these activities and responsibilities. Where control is less essential, we entertain outsourcing. And business process outsourcing continues to be adopted at unprecedented rates, whether it's production, information technology, customer service, logistics, legal services, or other functions. Once it's determined what the company will buy, the supply management organization can take shape. Critical to forming the organization is understanding the scope of the work required. If the company operates from multiple locations, how much responsibility will rest with a central purchasing organization, and how much will rest with each location? Organizations opting for centralized control decide what to buy, select the suppliers, and initiate the orders, all from headquarters. Field personnel will verify that the quality and quantity of supplies meets expectations, but will make no strategic decisions. The benefits of such a system include the consolidation of the spend, ensuring that the company achieves volume discounts from suppliers and high-priority service by virtue of putting large chunks of the business in the hands of fewer suppliers. Centralized control can also support greater standardization of supply across the various field locations. Imagine, for instance, if every McDonald's restaurant could order supplies from any vendors the location chose. Would the experience for the customer be uniform from location to location? In pursuit of that uniform experience, McDonald's corporate office tightly controls the supply arrangements for the store locations. The disadvantage of such a system, though, is that it doesn't allow the field operations to exert their influence on suppliers or to address any of their specific needs. When operations differ considerably across locations, it can be difficult for the central organization to understand the diverse needs of the field operations. Decentralized control allows the field locations to act autonomously, to freely choose suppliers, and to negotiate directly with them. While the individual needs of the locations can be addressed in these arrangements, the volume of spend may not be sufficiently large for suppliers to warrant the most competitive price or highest priority service. Most good-sized companies pursue a blended strategy, which involves headquarters centralizing the planning of supply and the field locations controlling the buying actions. Central planning includes the selection of suppliers and negotiations on volumes, quality, and pricing. Such arrangements try to achieve balance between the control of centralization and the flexibility of decentralization. Those strategic decisions are left with headquarters. With the organization in place, companies then set forward a strategy for engaging suppliers. The strategy will be based in large part on what is purchased. Most companies must acquire what I call mission-critical supplies. These are the items that influence the quality of the products and services your company provides. These items may also be visible to customers. The counter to these visible and mission-critical items are the invisible commodity items. Whereas you might emphasize quality with the mission-critical stuff, price might be the highest priority for the commodity items. Also, the amount of time you spend worrying about supplier relationships will largely depend on how critical the supplies are to your products and services. A supplier of maintenance, repair, and operating supplies that don't go directly into your product won't warrant extensive preparation and negotiation compared to a supplier that can help you win or cause you to lose in the marketplace. Given the complexities associated with working the suppliers of mission-critical inputs, let's focus on these dealings. You might ask, how many suppliers of a given input is ideal? There are competing theories weighing in on this question. Some believe that fewer suppliers is better, even going so far as to recommend sole sourcing, having one supplier responsible for a given item. The benefit of sole sourcing is that you concentrate the spend in one place, which should elevate the volume discount. It's also easier to manage one supplier than several. Through a close working relationship, sole sourcing might foster a high level of collaboration between a company and its supplier. The dependency inherent in sole sourcing arrangements drives many supply professionals away from them, however. By virtue of placing all of one's business for a given input in the hands of a single supplier, you may be cutting out the positive influences of competition for price and quality. In other words, the supplier could act opportunistically, taking advantage of the dependent arrangement to raise prices and not offer the priority you might be justified in enjoying. Quite simply, you could be held captive to the supplier. This isn't an enviable position to be in, and you may not even have a choice in the matter. There may be only one supplier for a given input, forcing you to go with a sole source arrangement. When that's the case, companies sometimes revisit the make versus buy decision and consider creating what they were going to purchase instead. This can require a lot of capital and can distract you from your primary business. A company would have to feel very vulnerable and disadvantaged to insource something that had previously been outsourced. But it happens. Boeing resorted to this strategy to support production of the 787 Dreamliner aircraft. When the closely watched launch of the project fell behind schedule, Boeing acquired major airframe and parts suppliers to ensure that the job got done. A well-heeled business might also buy its supplier and take control of the supply of input in order to limit access to competitors or to make its competitors dependent on it for that input. Amazon.com acquired a company called Kiva Systems in 2012. Kiva is a market-leading developer of material handling equipment, things like high-speed conveyor systems and robotic devices used in the storing and sorting of products in high-volume distribution centers. Through the acquisition, Amazon acquired an in-house provider of technology that's dedicated to supporting the company's aggressive growth plans. It also took a venerable supplier away from its competitors. The acquisition carried a price tag of $775 million, but many analysts believe that it was a smart move in light of what it does for Amazon and how it impacts the competition. Another school of thought on the number of suppliers to work with is to hire many suppliers and to incite a feeding frenzy mentality among them. The belief is that by not allowing the company to be dependent on any one or few suppliers, competition will intensify and suppliers will cut prices to the bone to get the company's business. This is usually a short-term proposition, however, as suppliers usually look for large chunks of business that are repetitive, allowing them to smooth their own operations and reduce transaction cost. In fact, the feeding frenzy usually consists of a group of desperate suppliers vying for the business and fails to induce the stronger players to compete, since the stronger players are able to more freely pick and choose among the business opportunities. Further, you're less likely to pursue continuous improvement with suppliers under the bargain shopping arrangement, since suppliers are not plugged into your business. They never get a chance to really know your business, and the cost of managing a diverse array of suppliers can be taxing. Here, too, we tend to see a middle ground strategy that is usually preferred. Most progressive companies will avoid sole sourcing, and yet they're not constantly on the prowl for new suppliers. Rather, they look at the portfolio of items and services they buy. They look for opportunities for consolidating the spend, which will provide leverage in negotiations. They look for opportunities for collaboration with suppliers of critical parts and try not to only get the best price for these inputs, but to win over the interest of these suppliers. Where over-dependencies present vulnerability, companies will seek some redundancy, additional suppliers that can reduce the dependency and incite a level of honesty and competition in the business. Many companies elect to dual or tri-source the supply of critical items to provide an element of competition while still providing each supplier a sufficient piece of the action to bring forward the best of what they have to offer. The allocation will not always be, say, a 50-50 split between the two vendors of an item, and instead might float from year to year to reward a supplier for exemplary performance or to incite competition. With the right number of suppliers determined, how do companies go about selecting their suppliers? Again, I'll focus on the supply of critical parts here, as the procurement of commodity items is largely based on availability and price. The selection of suppliers for critical inputs is more involved, as you can imagine. It's become common for large supply management organizations to spend a preponderance of their time qualifying suppliers. Supplier qualification is the practice of establishing standards for doing business with the company. In light of the vast interest in serving large companies, corporations employ qualification as a way to filter the interest, requiring prospective suppliers to meet standards established in areas of quality, capacity, safety, and ethical performance. It's the way that supply managers demonstrate that to their higher-ups that they've done their homework on selecting suppliers. Once the qualifications for competing for business are in place, you can finally approach the supply market. But how do you go about this? Do you pick up the phone and start calling suppliers? Or do you post your business to an industry bulletin board and wait for the calls to come in? Your approach will depend both on your situation and, again, what you're buying. If you're a seasoned buyer of an item, then you'll likely know who to contact, who has the capabilities, capacity, and pricing to be competitive. You might even set up something called a reverse auction, where you invite select players to compete in real time for the business, choosing the supplier that brings forward the lowest price. Now, what makes a reverse auction reverse from a conventional auction? Two things. One, it's the buyer that initiates the sale, as opposed to the seller, who would do so in a conventional auction. And two, the lowest bid wins the auction, not the highest bid, as you would find with a seller-initiated auction. I equate reverse auctions to online dating. Don't be surprised if everything is not as it appears once the goods are delivered. If you base a supply decision entirely on price, you may find that what you order falls short of your standards. If simply putting your business out to bid and shopping for low price is not the answer, then you'll likely have to take an intermediate step to see what prospective suppliers might have to offer. This is usually the case when buying something new. It also applies when you want to renew the competition for the business. In either case, you'll engage in a formal interviewing process. And here I'm talking about interviewing a company, which at the outset typically happens on paper. There are three basic forms of such interviews. The request for information, known as an RFI, a request for quote, RFQ, and a request for proposal, RFP. I'll explain each briefly. The RFI is where you solicit basic information from prospective vendors, trying to figure out who they are and what they have to offer. It's usually the precursor to a request for quotes or proposals. The request for quotes is where you spell out what you're looking for in a product or service and seek the vendor's best provision and price. Finally, the request for proposals is more open-ended. You present a problem to the prospective vendors and ask for solutions. As you can imagine, RFPs are the most complex responses to evaluate and judge, but can lead to breakthrough thinking when you're open to ideas. When it's time to make supplier selections, most companies today are looking beyond the purchase price of the products and services they buy. Instead, they're considering what's known as the total cost of ownership, or TCO, associated with the purchase. This is a way of bringing a so-called life cycle perspective into the procurement of goods and services. That term makes sense because TCO considers not only the purchase price, but all of the costs associated with acquisition, like the cost of financing the purchase and preparing the business to use the materials or products, incorporating the full life cycle of the input over the course of its use. To that end, total cost of ownership also factors in the cost of use, including the cost of carrying inventory. But it's in the determination of a product's post-use factors that the life cycle perspective of TCO can really alter the landscape of the purchasing decision. In post-use, we might concern ourselves with the cost of dissatisfied customers. These customers might find defects in the goods or services attributed to the inputs that we purchased. There may be warranty costs associated with addressing these unhappy customers. The issue might escalate into a recall, which can be exorbitantly expensive for a company. If the item poses hazards of any kind, product liability might factor in. Finally, companies are taking greater interest and responsibility for the environmental impacts of products and packaging material in the post-use phase. Can the product be reused, remanufactured, or recycled? If the product does not contain reusable content and must be discarded, is there any special handling required? In sum, the life cycle perspective espoused in total cost of ownership revolutionizes the act of buying stuff. It's a 180-degree turn from traditional purchasing practice, and and requires much deeper thought than simply shopping for prices and specs ever did accommodate. I'm going to skip over the negotiation and legal aspects of supply management, as those topics justify courses all to themselves. Rather, I'd like to offer some tips for keeping your suppliers engaged and working hard for you. The first tip relates to maintaining open communications with your suppliers, especially the ones that are most critical to your business. No one likes to be kept in the dark about how things are going, and the best suppliers are the ones that are ready to make adjustments when needed. A bad scenario that I hear about from time to time involves suppliers losing business without having the opportunity to remedy a problem. In fact, they often don't even know there's a problem, or at least they're not aware of its severity in the eyes of the customer. The best way to keep this from happening is to talk, but even better, meet on a regular basis. In what I call high-touch relationships, this involves meeting not only in public or at headquarter locations, but going to where the work is performed. See the products and services in action and talk about what you see. This can inspire great discussion and also illuminates opportunities for improvement. At a minimum, you should provide regular feedback to all suppliers that are considered strategic for your business. A supplier scorecard might be issued monthly, for instance, to indicate performance on a wide array of performance dimensions and metrics. Be careful, though, not to overload the scorecard with too much data. It should serve as a mechanism for general evaluation, a conversation starter. Focus on the vital few measures that are most important to your business and explain in general how the supplier is doing. The basic dimensions of performance usually include quality, cost, and delivery. Other aspects like invoice accuracy, responsiveness to problems, and ease of doing business can be added too. Again, the purpose of a supplier scorecard is to provide a means of regular feedback and to point to improvement opportunities. Progressive companies are turning the mirror around, though, and asking suppliers how satisfied they are with the focal firm as a customer. Did you follow that? Companies are asking their suppliers how satisfied they are in serving the companies, their customers. Assessing supplier satisfaction is a fairly new phenomenon. It can be critically important when companies are chasing the interest of a common group of suppliers and trying to gain stature as a preferred customer to the best suppliers. Such assessments usually examine the ease of doing business. Does the customer company throw surprises at the supplier? Does the supplier regard the customer company as fair in its dealings? Are the benefits achieved through collaboration divided in an equitable fashion? Such assessments are rarely conducted by customer companies themselves, as there would be too much fear on the part of suppliers in openly complaining about their customers. Instead, these surveys are conducted on behalf of companies by independent consultants or academics. They may also be conducted on an industry-wide basis, providing a very rich database of benchmarks to use in future decision-making. Beyond merely evaluating suppliers, progressive companies also take the time to recognize excellence. It's not uncommon for customer companies to host annual banquets or quarterly gatherings where they assemble their suppliers for a celebration of past successes and offer a look toward the future. You may also have heard horror stories of these meetings turning into browbeating sessions or demands for pricing concessions, but I would warn strongly against using public forums for this purpose. Who would bother to show up next year if that were the case? No, use it as a time to engender camaraderie and bolster the team spirit that's essential to winning in today's competitive business environment. So what are the latest supply management practices that today's leading-edge companies are employing? They're moving toward what's known as supply chain competition. Companies no longer merely compete head-to-head, but also supply chain to supply chain, pitting their entire input to delivered output systems against those of their rivals. With that in mind, there's a race to win the hearts, minds, and attention of the best, most innovative companies, your suppliers. These are the suppliers that possess unique intellectual property, processing capabilities, and in some cases, branding to bolster your products and services. Beyond merely gaining the attention of these suppliers, though, you want to enlist them to help you to compete. This can take the form of early supplier involvement, where suppliers help to devise the next generation of products and services. Early supplier involvement will marry up the technical personnel across the companies to devise a common picture for the future. It may also result in joint venture opportunities or licensing arrangements when the market proves promising. At a minimum, the involvement of suppliers early in the new product development process can highlight the limitations or challenges that you'll run into should you elect to proceed with a bold new technology. The PC industry is laden with intense collaborations between hardware manufacturers and software providers. For instance, how did Intel ever make it important to us consumers to have Intel inside our computers? They worked closely with PC manufacturers to devise leading technologies and worked out deals to have their logo placed on the outside of the hardware itself. That's pretty good for a supplier of what would otherwise be an invisible part of the computer. It then became important for the PC makers to show that an Intel processor chip was inside the machine, working its magic. Computers lacking the Intel logo then were at something of a disadvantage. This speaks to supply chain competition. Two or more companies working together to set themselves apart in the market. Clearly, if collaboration is to endure between companies, it's essential that both parties benefit from the collaboration. So it also becomes important to figure out how to divvy the financial and non-financial rewards that come from the relationship. I mentioned non-financial rewards here. For dollars, cents, and long-term contracts are not the only way to compensate a supplier for a good idea, being easier to do business with, providing access to markets, intelligence, or other resources can be very helpful to suppliers, not to mention devising case studies or facilitating introductions to other prospective customers. These can be some of the non-financial ways to reward a supplier. There's clearly room for creativity in figuring out how to engage and reward suppliers for bringing forward innovations in products and processes. Of all the strategic supply management initiatives gaining adoption today, supply risk management is perhaps getting the most buzz. In fact, it's such a big and pressing topic that I'll devote an entire lecture to the subject of running an agile and resilient business at the end of this course. For now, suffice to say that in a world where things are moving so fast and complexity is increasing, companies must make every effort to stay on top of the supply base in order to mitigate risk. This means understanding where any possible hiccup in supply operations can impede or possibly shut down your business. The situation which no supply manager wants to find him or herself is explaining how and why a supplier problem prevented the company from serving its customers, or why a supplier that produced poor quality or violated ethical standards. These instances shed a negative light on the company by virtue of the business relationship that the supply manager oversaw. As the complexity of business increases, companies are increasingly being held accountable for the social and environmental actions they take. And the accountability is not limited to the operations performed directly by a company, but also by those parties with which it does business in the supply chain. This has forced companies to shine a light into the dark corners of their supply chains to understand who is doing what throughout the full scope of operations, from material extraction through assembly, distribution, and consumption. And sometimes companies are being held accountable for the post-use phase as well, as the life cycle perspective of total cost of ownership reminds us. These are some of the things that keep supply managers up at night. They don't have easy jobs, but that's the price of working in an area that has become so important to business success.
This lecture is titled, The Long Reach of Logistics.
Have you ever gone shopping expressly to buy something that a store advertised, only to find that the item wasn't available when you showed up? How'd that make you feel? Probably frustrated that you bothered to make the trip only to come away empty-handed. What would you guess is the percentage of time that items are out of stock? 1% of the time? 5%? More? In a grocery setting, the number can be as high as 20%. Now, it doesn't seem that high, though, does it? And why is that? Because the grocery store is literally full of products, and we can usually check everything off our shopping list by making substitutions right there in the grocery aisle. The size you're looking for isn't on the shelf? Just buy a larger or smaller size. The flavor you're looking for isn't available? It's a good time to try a new flavor, don't you think? Your favorite brand is missing? Try a different brand. But substitutions aren't always possible. Research shows that retailers lose about 4% of sales due to stockouts. Now, that may not sound like much, but in an industry that operates on razor-thin margins of 2 to 3%, that can make the difference between profit and loss. Stockouts became such a big problem at Walmart in 2013 that the company started tying executive compensation to in-stock performance at the store shelf. The topic for this lecture is the discipline that, among other things, seeks to keep stockouts from happening, logistics. While we often talk about the logistics of a meeting or the logistics of a trip, the logistics we're exploring here is the business function responsible for ensuring that the right products are available in the right quantities and condition at the right place at the right time to meet customers' expectations. The field of logistics embraces the transportation and distribution of products, but it's something more. It's the overarching planning, timing, optimization, and coordination involved in getting products where they need to be, when they need to be there. Wherever there's a physical separation between a source of supply and points of demand, it's the job of logistics to find a way to close the gap by delivering goods to customers in an effective and efficient manner. When logistics works well, it largely goes without notice, for we expect that the stuff we want will be available when and where we want it. But there's a lot of thought, even science, that goes into assuring that products reach customers. And the business of logistics is substantial. About $1.4 trillion is spent each year in the United States alone to support the storage and transportation of goods. That's about 8% of the nation's gross domestic product. Let me put it another way. Nearly a dime out of every dollar spent in the U.S. goes toward logistics activity. In this lecture, we'll examine three key aspects of logistics. The first is logistics' role in providing the company's reach in the market through its chosen distribution strategy. From there, we'll discuss the logistics network required to support the distribution strategy. Finally, we'll look at the operational aspects of logistics, the movement, storage, and technology used to meet customer requirements. First, let's look at distribution strategy. Distribution is the spreading of product throughout the marketplace so a large number of people can buy the product. It's how customers access our products. It encompasses the warehousing, transportation, and tracking of our goods into the marketplace, and this requires strategy. We'll consider three distinct distribution strategies for accessing the market: intensive, exclusive, and selective distribution. Some businesses aspire to have their products in the hands of every customer in a region or market. This is called intensive distribution. Consumer goods companies like Coca-Cola, General Mills, and Unilever seek to have their products in every household. In order for these companies to earn sizable profits on their narrow margins, they must sell tremendous volumes of their product, engaging in contentious battles for market share. General Mills sells about 180 million boxes each year of America's favorite breakfast cereal. Yep, Cheerios. Well, Honey Nut Cheerios is actually the most popular flavor. In essence, companies like General Mills employ intensive distribution to blanket the market with their products. At the opposite extreme to intensive distribution is exclusive distribution. Exclusive distribution involves getting products in the hands of a limited number of people, but offering a high-touch or customized buying experience for customers. This approach is often associated with high-priced luxury goods like jewelry, fashion merchandise, and sports cars. Manufacturers employing exclusive distribution tightly control production and distribution. They either distribute the goods themselves or align with a limited number of distributors and retailers who must often be licensed to carry their merchandise. Unsanctioned channels, or so-called black markets, sometimes manifest around these brands. A third strategy, selective distribution, fits somewhere in between the intensive and exclusive distribution approaches. Companies pursuing selective distribution have more customers than exclusive providers and fewer than intensive providers. Distribution might be selective in terms of the number and types of customers reached or in terms of the location served. Depending on the desired intensity of the market coverage, any one of these three alternatives might support a company's competitive basis, how it intends to win in the marketplace. And many companies will employ multiple distribution strategies, using a different approach for different brands under the company's umbrella. In the auto industry, many manufacturers possess multiple brands in their portfolio. General Motors has Chevrolet, Buick, Cadillac, and GMC, as well as brands that they sell outside the U.S. market, like Opel, Vauxhall, and others in Europe. Honda has its flagship brand and the Acura line. These companies employ intensive distribution for their mainstay brands and selective distribution for their premium brands. For instance, there are more than 1,400 Toyota dealerships in the U.S., but only 230 dealers for the company's Lexus brand. Small cities with a population of 30,000 or more are likely to have a Toyota dealership. Yet, it requires a city to have 4 to 5 times that population to have a Lexus dealership. So there's a strong correlation between the distribution strategy employed by a company and the number and placement of locations required to support that strategy. The second aspect of logistics we'll examine, the logistics network, involves the locations from which a business operates and the function or purpose of those locations. Every business must consider the network over which it wants to conduct business such that it first reaches customers with its products and second can access key sources of product supply. It's here that we realize that logistics is involved in both the inbound and outbound sides of the business. Finding the right number and placement of locations involves not just science, but art. The art comes in the sense of importance that you impart to customers. If you establish a store or a warehouse location near customers, what message does that convey to them? It conveys that they're important. If, on the other hand, you welcome customers to order from your catalog or website and then tell them that they can expect delivery in a week, What does that convey to them? Yet it's impossible to be located close to all customers when they're scattered about a large geographic area. Stores and warehouses are expensive. That's where you rely on science to figure out how you can achieve the best reach with the fewest facilities. You want the optimal blend of market access and cost containment. The science of logistics is nothing new. In fact, it has its origins in military science, ensuring that warfighters are sufficiently armed, fed, and clothed for battle. And that's been recognized for centuries as key to winning military conflicts. In fact, historians argue that logistics has factored significantly in the empire-building campaigns of every great leader, dating back to Thutmose III of Egypt, who invaded Lebanon by sea in the 15th century BC. It's believed that logistical failures by British forces helped to secure American independence nearly 240 years ago. The same could be said of every battle since. And today, logisticians are among the first forces on the ground at the outset of any effective military campaign. One term that military strategists use routinely is center of gravity. The center of gravity of an enemy is its concentration of forces in a conflict. It represents a source of vulnerability. If one can knock out a key enemy base or supply depot, then the opposing force is hamstrung and unable to support its warfighters on various fronts. Commercial enterprises put logistical lessons from the battlefield to use in everyday business. In business, the center of gravity represents the best place to locate a distribution point, given the inbound supply and outbound distribution locations. It's the optimal point at which the total distance that must be covered in from supply locations and out to demand locations is minimized. Let's look at an example to help illustrate the center of gravity concept. Imagine, for instance, that your company wants to serve customers throughout the United States on an intensive basis. You might elect to hold all of your inventory in a single location, say, Topeka, Kansas. This seems like a good choice since Topeka is a geographically central location for your market. But what if 80% of your sales comes from the eastern United States? That would pull your center of gravity toward the east. A location like Columbus, Ohio might make more sense, assuming that you can supply the distribution location efficiently. This helps to explain why my hometown, Columbus, Ohio, is known as a distribution city. It serves as a center of gravity in the logistics networks of many companies. Customers located close to Columbus are pretty happy about this, for their orders get filled and delivered quickly. However, customers in Seattle, Washington might not be, because it takes longer for deliveries to reach that more distant location. The most direct driving route from Columbus to Seattle is just over 2,400 miles. That's about 35 hours of driving time. For this reason, most businesses elect to operate from several disparate locations to serve a large market like the United States. And the number of locations to operate tends to grow as the business grows. Competition can also fuel the need to increase the number of distribution and store locations. When a rival establishes a presence in a market, it creates a need to match the competitor's strategic move with one of your own. Restaurant chains and retailers routinely demonstrate this behavior. Have you ever noticed that when a Target store opens in a locality, Walmart is soon to follow, or vice versa? But there are a few checks on the logic of adding more locations to a logistics network. Of course, more facilities means a higher warehouse and real estate investment. But you can also expect to invest more in inventory as you add distribution points to your network. Why is that? It's been proven that a company will need more safety stock inventory when it adds locations to its network. Safety stock is the inventory that a company holds just in case there's an increase in demand or a delay in supply. This is opposed to the inventory called cycle stock that a company maintains to cover itself for forecasted sales and normal supply lead times. The greater the uncertainty a company faces, the more safety stock that's required. Mathematicians had devised something called the square root rule, which predicts that the amount of safety stock that a company holds will double when the number of locations quadruples. In other words, if a retailer increases its store count from one location to four, the safety stock inventory held across the four locations will be twice as much as when the company had a single location. So the expected increase in inventory will discourage a company from adding too many facilities to its network. Transportation costs can also make adding too many distribution points unattractive. When you add locations, you have to keep in mind that you have to ship to these locations. Even though you're getting closer to customers on the outbound side of the business, it's on the inbound side to these locations that transportation costs can consume you. The final check on the logic of adding locations to better serve a market is that of cannibalization. When sales flatten and saturation is achieved in the market, any sales gain for one location is accomplished at a loss to another location. When the gain comes at the expense of a competitor, hey, that's good, marking an advance in market share. When the gain comes from the retailer's own partner stores, though, there may be little or no benefit at all. Have you ever driven down a street only to pass a steady stream of McDonald's restaurants seemingly on every block? The same might be said of Subway or Starbucks. These companies seek intensive coverage of the markets they serve, especially in densely populated areas. McDonald's operates about 14,000 stores throughout the U.S. This means that the average U.S. consumer is never more than 20 miles from a McDonald's restaurant. Subway boasts 26,000 U.S. stores, making them nearly omnipresent around the United States. When the restaurants are clustered closely together, like in most metropolitan areas, the competition can be intense, with individual stores fighting for business. Cannibalization occurs when the consumer buys from one Subway store instead of another. Determining the right number of locations is something of a moving target for many companies because markets are dynamic and logistics networks are fairly permanent, or at least very costly to change. That's why companies often progress on a growth path, adding facilities along the way, only to stop at some point and realize that they've become oversaturated in coverage. They then remove a large number of facilities, but soon start to grow again. It's like a pendulum swinging. To help accommodate companies' need to expand and contract networks, some businesses seek the help of third-party logistics services. Third-party logistics providers, or 3PLs as they're known, own the warehouse and transportation assets to help their clients expand and contract as needed. Outsourcing, as you'll recall, involves hiring an outside company to perform one or more activities on your behalf. Companies of all kinds rely on 3PLs today to provide dynamic network solutions. Internet retailers who lack conventional brick-and-mortar stores often outsource the entirety of their distribution needs to capable third-party logistics companies. For these reasons, the U.S. third-party logistics industry totaled $146 billion in 2013. The global market for these services was estimated at nearly $800 billion, and both the U.S. and global markets continue to grow. In lieu of outsourcing, some companies work with distributors and wholesalers to achieve broader coverage to a larger market than they could attain on their own. When manufacturers rely on intermediaries like distributors and wholesalers, we say they're using indirect channels of distribution. The obvious disadvantage to such arrangements is that you lose direct touch with the end customer who now buys from the intermediary. So some of the intensity that you're seeking with intensive distribution is lost here. Also, the intermediary is likely to sell products offered by your competitors too. Consequently, you must now try to appeal not only to the end customers in the market, but also the intermediaries, in hopes that they'll stock and actively sell your products. Exclusive distribution, and to a lesser extent, selective distribution, tends to work through fewer intermediaries. It employs direct channels, selling direct to the end customers as a way to ensure high-touch service and build customer affinity for the brand and its products. Once a company has its distribution and logistics network in place, it needs to focus on the operational side of logistics, delivering to customers or store locations where customers will obtain its products. Here we focus on what is known as the order cycle, or lead time, which is the amount of time from order receipt until delivery. The faster and more reliable our lead time, the happier customers will be. Research has shown that better availability and lead time reductions are important ways to gain business. Actor, writer Woody Allen once quipped that 80% of success is showing up. Logisticians would largely agree with that assertion. But showing up promptly can be just as important. Procter & Gamble, the world's largest consumer goods company, is well aware of this reality. P&G has long managed its business on the basis of successfully meeting what it calls the two moments of truth. The first moment of truth is associated with ensuring that the P&G product is available when and where the consumer wants to buy it. The second moment of truth, then, is when the product performs as the consumer expects. What P&G realized is that the second moment of truth doesn't happen with failure in the first moment. You can't enjoy the benefits of fresh breath and white teeth if the Crest toothpaste isn't on the shelf. The company took this idea so seriously that it created a senior position it called Director of First Moment of Truth to help to ensure that it received its due attention. It takes great planning and execution to deliver on that first moment of truth. Much of the execution in this stage of logistics rests with transportation. Transportation represents what we often call the last mile segment of the order cycle, the physical delivery of goods on time and safely to customers. Transportation also represents the biggest share of logistics costs for most companies. Of the $1.4 trillion spent for all logistics activity in the United States in 2013, transportation accounted for $852 billion of this sum, or 62% of logistics cost. Transportation alone accounts for just over 5% of U.S. gross domestic product. Choosing the right means of transporting goods can have major cost and service implications for a company. Naturally, speed and dependability usually come at a higher price. It may cost 70% more to ship a product next day to a customer than to use two-day delivery. There are five basic modes of transportation, each with its own cost and service implications. You no doubt are aware of them, but you may have never given them much thought. Companies can move product by air, truck, rail, water, or pipeline. Let's start with truck transportation. It's the most common means today, given that it's so readily available and is generally regarded as fast and reliable. Most products will move by truck at some point in their distribution. Air transportation tends to be preferred with time-critical deliveries that must cover long distances, like urgent cross-country or international shipments. High-value goods like consumer electronics and pharmaceuticals often move by plane. Items thought to be highly perishable, like fresh-cut flowers, or products with short market life cycles, like the latest fashion apparel, often move by plane too. Transportation by railroad is popular for shipments that allow for longer transit times over longer distances, like hauling grains from Iowa to New York, or coal from West Virginia to Arizona. Transportation by water including rivers, great lakes, and oceans, is preferred for the transport of massive quantities of goods. When time is not so important and navigable waterways connect the origin and the destination points. And finally, pipeline transportation is currently limited to commodities that are fluid in nature, like oil and gas. Big energy companies often rely on pipelines to transport immense volumes of oil and natural gas. Sometimes the best transportation solution involves combining the modes for a shipment. This is called intermodal transportation. Consider the path for a container full of toys going from Hong Kong to Dallas, Texas. The container might move by truck from the Chinese factory to the port in Hong Kong. It might then travel on a huge ship along with thousands of other containers to Los Angeles. From LA, the container would move by train to Dallas, and then finally by truck to the customer location on the north side of the city. This whole sequence might take 3 weeks compared to an overnight flight by plane, but the cost of shipping by plane is almost 20 times greater than by ship, making the intermodal option attractive despite the big difference in transit time. The five modes of transportation offer different levels of service in terms of speed, reliability, and capacity. And while most items will move by truck at some point in their distribution, moving things by truck can be expensive, energy intensive, and generate too much greenhouse gas emissions. Transportation in total consumes 13 million barrels of oil each day in the U.S. and tops all other commercial activities in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. This strikes many as an unsustainable solution. For these reasons, I expect that we'll use railroads to move freight and people much more in the years ahead. Rail is a much more fuel-efficient and lower-emission form of transport, but it also would help to take a lot of trucks off the roadways. I don't know about you, but I get a little nervous sharing the roads with all those trucks. Trucking companies are also having a hard time finding enough drivers to operate those trucks. And this is leading to an unprecedented level of cooperation between trucking companies and railroads, in which trucking companies have started selling intermodal services for truck-rail-truck combinations. Trucks provide the local pickup and delivery services, while railroads handle the long distance between the two localities, origin and destination. This follows nearly a century of intense head-to-head competition between these two modes of transportation. Iconic investor Warren Buffett made a major investment in the railroads in 2010 when his firm Berkshire Hathaway purchased the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad. At $34 billion, it's Berkshire Hathaway's largest acquisition to date. Mr. Buffett is clearly very bullish on the future of the railroads, and I'd have to agree. The future could also be marked by modes of transportation that we've never seen before, like the use of aerial drones for short-distance home deliveries. Amazon made headlines in 2014 by announcing that the company is experimenting with unmanned aerial drones, small programmable helicopters for making home deliveries from nearby order fulfillment centers. Other companies like FedEx have since announced their intentions to use drones too. The Federal Aviation Administration will have to clear the way though, as regulations currently oppose the use of drones for commercial purposes, despite their common usage for military and recreational purposes. Experiments are also in place to test other new modes of transportation, like underground pipelines for shipping non-liquid cargo, or using lighter-than-air vehicles, blimps, for moving really big cargo, like huge pieces of industrial equipment, over oceans. These experiments are taking place primarily in Europe, which tends to be more open and adventuresome when it comes to innovative forms of transportation. Europeans are also leading the way in ride-sharing for freight, where multiple companies, sometimes even competitors, share warehouses and transportation capacity as ways to improve the utilization of facilities and transportation capacity. Advanced technologies and information systems are also influencing how we fulfill logistics activity. Technologies like transportation management systems and warehouse management systems are helping companies manage the complexities of these operations and make smarter decisions. I recently toured a large automated distribution center operated by giant retailer Target, where a warehouse management system directed robotic equipment on which items to pick, pack, and ship to Target's store locations, designing each load for optimal storage efficiency in the store. The system actually knew where each item belonged in each of the 280 stores that the distribution center served, and it did everything with item-level shipping accuracy greater than 99.8%. That's pretty hard for us humans to pull off without the aid of automation. Communicative technologies like the internet, GPS, and radio frequency identification link companies, enhance information exchange, and improve visibility of supply and demand across companies. Improved visibility is yielding innovations in how companies work together. One such advent is the development of vendor-managed inventory, or VMI. As its name implies, VMI is where a vendor or supplier of a product assumes responsibility for managing inventory that resides at a buyer's location. Under these arrangements, the vendor is held accountable for any stockouts the buyer experiences. Some companies have gone a step further than VMI with vendor-owned and managed inventory, or VOMI. Here, the vendor not only manages the inventory residing at a customer location, but retains ownership of it until the product is sold. This sounds like consignment, doesn't it? Consignment often carries a negative connotation, so it goes by other terms like VOMI.